Welcome to CSCE's This Compassionate Life with Linda Caldwell. Linda is a chef, writer, and food and farms advocate in Portland, Oregon. She is a driving force behind the efforts of Portland Public Schools, the City of Portland, and local partners, including farms, to bring fresh local food into school cafeterias while teaching kids about its benefits. Through her work, she exposes people to lessons in botany, environmental appreciation, food education, and character development in a school garden.
I was involved with a bunch of chefs doing a lot of activist work. This local board in Portland of the Chefs Collaborative, I was the only one with children. And so the educational component and program sort of got passed towards me, and I had easy access into the public school system. And so I started to do a lot of work in teaching elementary and middle school students about sustainable food systems from a chef's point of view. And some of the questions and critical thinking that has to come along with that. How do you really make choices? And how do you have the knowledge to make choices that are value-based? Well, I was always looking on the side and catching as much information as I could about the USDA and the school lunch program and the foods that are actually served in school lunchrooms, especially in urban environments, and had this great opportunity to partner with a large school district here in Portland and begin to work with them to remake, really, what food was served on the plate. And this was in 2006 when the federal government had a mandate for all school districts to have a wellness policy. And in Portland, the Portland Public Schools Wellness Policy is another one of those sort of publicly mandated, not publicly funded programs, but really has some great structure to it. If you devoted some time and some energy and some money and some resources to, you could come up with some really great ways of supporting it and implementing it. School gardens and garden-based education and a sense of what organ agriculture is and changing the food on the plate are all components of the wellness policy. If the school kitchen is right in this part of the building, and then you walk out this other door, if you were a child and you walked out for recess and there was a school garden there, it was really easy to see that connection between where they eat and then that the food is grown nearby. I am so in love with, and I am so fascinated with plant growth and change of seasons and the interdependence of environmental, you know, habitats, and that's all there in a school garden. I grew up in Portland and spent a number of summers at summer camp on the Oregon coast lying on rocks looking in tide pools. And what I remember about tide pools was just being blown away that you could look into this world, you know, and it could be a big one and it could be 5 feet deep, it could be 6 inches deep, but it was full of relationships. And everything had a different relationship with another thing. This thing ate that thing, and this thing kept this thing clean, and that thing kept that clean. And I just looked at gardens and foods that way, and that humans are part of that system. You know, when I talk to kids, it's a really interesting thing, because I want to say plants and animals, and we are sort of conditioned to say plants and people and animals, and we kind of move like we're different, but we're actually exactly the same as animals. We've just modified everything in the environment so much. And it's really those modifications that have kind of created this lack of balance in this larger structure, in this larger system. When I'm writing, you know, activities for garden-based education and things like that, I'm trying to really get children to, one, be curious about the place that they are looking at, and to really begin to articulate and define what they love about it. Because if they don't, if we don't grow an appreciation and an understanding and have a name for these things, then it's harder to defend them or hold on to them. You know, you can dig into the soil and see creatures, how they benefit or don't benefit the roots of the plants. And when the seasons change, the sound of the soil is different, the sound of the roots is different, it smells different, and the worms and the bugs are reacting differently in the soil. there's a lot of conversation in public health around what a healthy environment or a healthy civic environment is, and that some of the more progressive thought is really saying the school environment, the physical environment, the neighborhood environment, and the health of those neighborhoods, and how active people are, how engaged they are in their shared spaces, like a community garden or a school garden or the playground at a school, are becoming indicators of public health. And I think that's a really fascinating thing to look at, you know, is what makes us want to be in places and what makes us comfortable going to the school grounds to hang out. I was out at Lesher Farm this morning. City of Lake Oswego announced their final plan for how this whole piece of urban farmland is going to be redesignated. And there is a very large agricultural project out there, and there is a children's garden there, and Oregon Tilth has land there, and they teach there, and a number of community garden plots. And when you stand there and you look at it, there's just all this, you know, beautiful, diverse ways of growing food, you know, from field scale to small example for children to families who are growing for their own home. And this final plan moves all of this established agricultural land to a distant, less priority in terms of farming piece on another part of the whole site, and turns this whole area where all this agriculture is into a grass soccer field. And it's really remarkable to me, and the reason it was so remarkable is we've lost our ability in the urban environment to really calculate or put a value on this notion that, you know, I know the farmer who's running the farm out there, and she's been out there for a number of years, and every year she's made an investment in that soil, from how she rotates the crops to how she adds compost to how she lies fields fallow. And none of that is taken into consideration. You know, it's just sort of here, oh, you're just farming, we can put you over here and you can farm over here too. You know, in my mind, that's really a loss of knowledge, potentially from a planning point of view. If you took sort of a similar example and said, well, if this was a house and you would put, you know, all this time and effort in sourcing the wood, and you move stone from somewhere else, and someone just said, well, you know, we've decided you've got to go somewhere else. You know, it's sort of it's a really interesting thing, because I don't think we as a culture right now in the urban environment have really learned to hold on to what soil is and what food production is. So I think that there are a whole bunch of different ways that school gardens or field agriculture is relevant, because it teaches them about relationships and about the world. And sometimes I get exasperated when I think of, you know, these just insanely and wickedly complex ideas like how gardens affect academic achievement and hunger and obesity and healthy food system and environmental degradation and global climate change and community food security. Those are all sort of, those things are, to me, are the result of an overpopulation, and our system is just whacked out of balance. And it's like, well, how do you just sort of realign that? Do you trust what you know based on what you learn in the garden or in a tide pool or in agricultural fields? Or do you trust a city planner who says, well, it's more valuable in another way? We're only here temporarily, and the land is here for good. When I think about land use, or I think about how our communities are defined and how we build these relationships, there are things that exist in the world that are really not ours to claim, you know, whether it's water or rain or land or things that should transcend any corporate ownership. I don't know very much about land use policy and preserving land and urban and rural reserves. I know general ideas about it, and I know that I really value agricultural land, because once it's gone for good. And yet, because I'm a chef and I'm always looking at the world through food, the miracle of botany is just, it just never ceases to amaze me. And yet, how do we hold on to the foods that are really, truly traditional and old cultural things. And I toss this question frequently at my friends who are farmers, and I say, well, I understand that, you know, certain things can be part of the commons and everyone should benefit from them. But what happens when you're talking about a seed? To me, some of the most beautiful seeds are certain seeds that come from certain plants, and they've been preserved and they perform in a certain way predictably. There's a form of stewardship that happens around these preservation of seeds. And what happens when you lose those, whether it's because they've gone extinct, and they've gone extinct for any number of reasons, there's no market for them anymore, our collective palate has moved on from them and they're no longer valued, or they don't ship well, which is, you know, a real fascinating thing in the dynamic between a global and a local market and economy, or simply when a corporation decides that if they tweak that seed just so, then they can slap a patent on it and they own it and have like serious ramifications for the people. I think growing food is a right. I'm not sure how this connects to educating children about food, but I think it's really about educating children about anything in the world. Like, how do you make sure that kids are not accepting, but they continue to ask the questions and ask the questions that will stand up to a larger structure and a larger framework? What makes it the right of government policy to say, oh no, you're not allowed to slaughter chickens in your backyard anymore because there's a food safety issue, or you can't grow food anymore in your backyard because you might get sick because you don't know about it? I understand that historically that the commons have been related to more physical things like the land and privileges or rights that every human should have to access to certain things. And yet there's this abstraction around food that I can't quite get a handle on, because we take it so for granted in our culture. Just the work it takes to look at every single thing and the source of everything you ate in one day is tremendously challenging, and find out, you know, where that comes from. It's much easier to talk about those things than to actually practice them. And sometimes I think that's a result, perhaps, of the privilege of Western wealth. My son was a vegetarian for a while, and it was a real challenge to support his commitment to it as an individual growing and learning about the world, when I would say, you know, this is really a privilege that you live in an environment where you can say, I am going to do this, and you expect our social structure to support you in that. Sort of like, you know, what if you didn't have that choice? You know, what if you didn't have the ability to say, I want to do this? Where would your food come from? These are questions that sort of push me to really sort of think, what would happen if we didn't have access to the seeds that we've always depended upon, especially here in the Willamette Valley, which is one of the best seed breeding places in the world. I really feel like we take for granted our access and our knowledge. It's an extraordinary privilege because the agricultural land that we sit on here, it's a really powerful thing to say, well, when will that shift? And what will happen when it shifts? And how do we preserve that ownership? Collective ownership, not corporate ownership, but the collectiveness of that right to have autonomy.
I was just imagining a world in which the expectation was that everyone like Oreos, and what kind of reaction kids would have to that expectation. You mentioned earlier modifications that we have created, and I guess continue to create, that are causing a lack of balance. Aren't there a set of modifications that will right that balance?
There are a lot of people in the world to feed, and there is how I choose to live my life and the decisions that I make. And that balance thing is sort of a result of that. Our dream world is to be able to say, if everybody did this, then this is what it would look like. We would not be overproducing food. It would not be full of sugars. There would not be food shortages in other areas of the world. Do we need to produce as much meat as we're actually producing? And, you know, what is that about? Why are we producing that much meat? And and how much of that meat is actually eaten and how much of it is actually wasted. If you imagine this really, really large map of complicated factors, and then you sort of, for me, when I insert myself into that equation, I feel like I can only do the best that I can do and always try and do a little bit better. And also know that I can't always do a little bit better. There are parameters, or there's sort of the real world. When I started the Abernathy Scratch Kitchen, I was going to be serving 360 kids if they all ate on a given day. In order to create the program, I had to create in my mind this vision that my friend Barry, who was a farmer, would be driving his yellow 1968 Ford truck across the blacktop and delivering produce to the door in the kitchen. And that's how I would create this kitchen, right? That the product comes in and I would work with it and I would serve it. Could not be farther from the truth of the reality of how food actually moves in a large institutional system and what ability you have to direct purchase or not, and how it comes to you. And yet, for that entire time, I still had to have that picture of Barry, because he was always smiling. And it was a wonderful carrot that was where my vision was. But people mistake vision for where you end up. You know, you have to have a vision in order to create something out of nothing, so that you've at least got a place that you're headed. So that's just like a microcosm in terms of this large balance of things. You know, as a result, those first steps that I took and that vision that I had really did change the practices of Portland Public Schools food sourcing. On the one hand, it's the individual's ability to say, I'm going to do it in this way, or I'm going to make a change in this way and follow what I believe to be true. And yet you also have to be really realistic about the actual circumstances into which you're entering, because it may or may not be appropriate to bring a set of procedures or visions or protocols to an entirely new environment. In the end, the complexity of these problems that we face today, environmentally, in terms of health of our children, the presumed wealth, or the economic stability of a country, it all comes down to we can only do what we can do, and we can perpetuate that. I haven't been out to the farm to work in about 4 months for a number of reasons, and it's been a really good experience to not go, because it's made me realize just how profound of an effect it's had on my understanding of the world and how it feeds me. Both literally how it feeds me, but how it spiritually feeds me. Because now I know I can actually write about things and teach kids about them, because I've been on my knees digging horseradish in the rain.